Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Bob Treadway, internationally recognized top futurist and strategy advisor, keynote at the 2012 ISACA World Congress. Bob, thank you for coming in today and sharing your remarkable experiences with our audience. You know, I was there at that conference, and it was just amazing, your keynote.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. A pleasure to be with you.
Now, Bob, in your keynote at the 2012 ISACA World Congress, you gave some economic insights, which generated a lot of interest. And there was a lot of people really excited about some of the things you talked about. So can you talk further, for example, what are the key trends that will impact technology professionals?
Okay. You know, the audience at the World Congress, and as you recall, I was doing a keynote presentation, we tried to make it as interactive as possible, so there was a lot of conversation, not only among the audience members at times during my presentation, but between them and myself. They tend to agree with me that the global economy is complex, but that the probability of rapid improvement in it is slim at the moment. We essentially have two different things going on in the world. Some of the more developed areas of the world are slipping back into recession when we look at the European Union and here in North America. But on the other hand, other areas, including Asia, are still doing quite well. So, you know, my view is, and I think some of the excitement, if you will, and concern on the part of the audience members was over the slip back into recession, possibly for an extended period, not only in the European Union, but also in the Americas. Typically, as a futurist, I don't look as closely at near-term kinds of forecasts as I did and continue to do today with the sort of unique circumstances that we're in with the economy. So how does that impact technology professionals? It means that things could be difficult. Things could be slow for some period of time. You know, obviously the general economy's impact on the corporate and government sectors are going to impact technical professionals and executives. But I think there's also both a negative and a positive aspect to the impacts. And we heard some of that in some of the audience responses there, you know, at the San Francisco meeting. While a lot of corporations are in very good capital positions, and overall business has actually, with the exception of sectors like construction and others, have really been in excellent shape. Financial services are stressed these days because of a lot more government inside, but there's going to be a reluctance on the part of a lot of organizations, whether they be government agencies or corporations, to commit to technology investments as long as there's uncertainty. And I don't see uncertainty easing for at least a year, if not maybe 2 or 3 years. And as a consequence, that means difficult decisions, potential delays in hiring in some cases. I think we'll see tough decisions on infrastructure investments. And I think there'll also be a tendency to try to continue to do business in the status quo. Now, that doesn't mean that that's uniform. I'm trying to paint things with a broad brush. In Europe, we're going to see declines in technology spending. We're going to see difficulty in budgets, as we discussed at the World Congress and as I showed information from Gartner, among others. But that situation changes fairly rapidly. On the positive, and that's the negative side, but on the positive side, you know, delays in hiring might make talent more available. This is one of the ongoing concerns, I think, in the technology sector. Can you find the right people? Technology talent might be migrating away from the more heavily impacted areas of the world. They might be migrating out of certain industries that have been heavily impacted, and they may become more available. There were sessions, and there were several discussions at the ISACA meeting that really revolved around that. And there's also the ability to, on the positive side, to quite frankly drive better bargains from vendors with a downturn looming. But right now, I'd place the odds for a North American slowdown, not necessarily Canada, but certainly the United States, into a recession at around 50%. It's really still a toss-up. As you alluded to, you know, some of my top information sources say that a slowdown, a recession, is a certainty in the United States, and it certainly is the case in large parts of the European Union right now. But, you know, could a slowdown, if it comes, be fairly lengthy? I think it's possible. I think it could be several quarters in the U.S. But again, you have to make decisions and you have to look at it strategically on the fact that, there's also a 50% probability that we could dodge a recession. We could see continued slow growth and perhaps an improvement over the next 2 to 3 years. And those are the economic sides of what we're looking at. But it's what I tried to do during my presentation, what I tried to bring out is that there's a wide cross-section of trends that impact technology professionals. As we continue the conversation, you and I here on this interview, these things will come up. But what I'd offer as an opening piece of advice is that individuals who are listening to this be especially alert to the factors that are outside of technology, probably outside of the company or the enterprise that are going to have the greatest effect. Typically, it's not the things that you're looking at most carefully in a particular narrow range. It's the broad range. And it's my belief that what a truly impactful executive does is that they don't predict, they forecast. And the difference is that a forecast is foresight that takes into account uncertainty and changes with time and new information. It's something that is an ongoing process. Let me give you just a brief example. I do not see IT people, for instance, taking into consideration how something that's completely unrelated, you would think, to technology is going to impact their areas of responsibility. And let me give you a word, sustainability. I think that sustainability, which could mean anything from the sourcing of energy or revised processes or new criteria for vendors, metrics that have never been applied before, will be in the future. I was looking just during my scanning recently at some aerial photographs of construction of a new Apple facility in Texas, and it has solar fields, fuel cells, other energy components, and I was thinking how a technology executive would look at this and think through the challenges for an operation that needs extraordinarily reliable and stable power sourcing is going to be impacted by something that's a drive towards sustainability. Just to close this off, last year's World Congress, not this year's, I was also the moderator in the closing keynote there. The opening presentation was by a couple of fighter pilots. I didn't know how well that would go over. They were actually responded to enthusiastically by the audience. But one of the points they made earlier in their portion of the program was that, and their quote was, 90% of your attention needs to be outside of the cockpit. And I believe that's true for almost any organization or profession.
That's really interesting. It's just all the different kinds of insights and the fact that you sort of put more details in this concept of forecast versus prediction. I think a lot of people sort of think they're the same thing, and as you're indicated, they're not. The other thing too is, what kind of impact do you see these economic trends having on the political climate? For example, in the U.S., you have an election coming up.
Oh yeah, the U.S. situation is complex. Down here, of course, we're very close to it, and it seems to be literally in our face, depending on where you live in the United States. We have a sort of a complex electoral system, and certain states are getting more impact than others. The economy seems to be the major issue between the two major presidential candidates. It seems to be less so in the election that I think is even going to be more important in the United States than the presidential election, and that is what happens in Congress, especially with our two different houses of Congress, what happens in the Senate as well. Will we see, a change in administration? Does the economy impact that? And how do the various candidates' approach to it resonate with the population, the voters, those that are franchised? And it's one of those things that really is unpredictable and to a large extent, and that's why I think you've got to apply this theory of forecasting, which is to look at a broad range of possibility, to look at the salient probabilities and try to prepare for it. Right now in the United States, the polls indicate that it's literally a dead heat, probably in the popular vote. In the electoral vote, it looked like it was leaning towards Romney, the Republican candidate. But recently, Barack Obama has come back in some of the what they call the battleground states. But, you know, between now and November, there's going to be several opportunities to forecast, and the predictions, as you probably might imagine, are going to change. But the economy is central to this. And we have something else that's looming in the U.S. that is going to happen just after the election, between what happens in early November and the first of the year. Congress needs to deal with something that it has been delaying for some period of time, which is the decision on the debt limit and essentially how it will handle expenditures in the future. The last time they did some gamesmanship and essentially played chicken on this by running at each other, it caused a decline in the economy that lasted for a couple of quarters. So it doesn't look favorable at this point, especially with something that I think is an overall trend that I think we'll probably discuss here in another few minutes.
Well, that's interesting, and I guess the debt limit challenge or conversation or debate also resulted in the lowering of the ratings, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. A good point. That's exactly what happened the last time the United States couldn't come to a reasoned decision with the divisiveness that we currently have in our political system in the U.S.
So now you've discussed some of the key trends. What are five other notable trends that you think we should be aware of?
Well, that's a large amount of territory, and you know, I saw this question in advance, so I tried to narrow it a bit. Related to what it was that we saw at ISACA, and something that I think IT professionals would consider, is that we're seeing heightened security risks. At the ISACA conference, many of the panels, many of the discussions rotated around, you know, increases. It was a conference about information security, obviously, and the security risks increasing. In fact, the term weaponized code that came up was something that I found chilling and something that is, I think, impacting the field. We've come to a new, very disturbing level of threats to business continuity, essential infrastructure, the intelligence that's and wisdom that's embedded in the enterprise. I think that's definitely a trend. What we've just been discussing when you asked about the political climate in the United States is that we're seeing a true divisiveness of governance in the United States, and I think we're also seeing it in the deeply stressed areas of Europe, Greece in particular. This is deeply disturbing. When you get entire nations that are divided, and in some cases evenly divided over essentially very very basic questions, it is deeply disturbing. It's going to hamper economic recovery, I think, here in the United States. It could cause some pullouts from the European Union. I think it will hamstring government action, and I think it's becoming more and more long-term. What we're seeing in the United States is the essentially abandonment of the governance system by many of what are known as the moderates, those who could bring both sides together, those who were the collaborators, are disappearing from our elected bodies in the United States, and it threatens something that is not only the world's largest single economy, which much of the rest of the world rotates around, but it also disturbs the world's greatest engine of innovation, because the United States, along with Canada and Japan and China and the European Union, are where we see the greatest number of advances that are improving life you know, around the world, and I think this is extraordinarily difficult. Another trend, and I think we saw examples of it at the ISACA conference, and it's not often thought of, but as an IT professional, I would be considering it, and that is, who are going to be the next 3 billion internet users? Because with Asia, Africa, the less developed countries, the kinds of things that are evolving now with the Arab Spring, we're going to see an awful lot of new users coming online, and that's going to change the character of not only the online world, but it will also create trigger effects that we're not considering, I think, right now. One of those is the long-term potential and influence of Africa. While it still may be decades away that we see the truly rapid growth in that part of the world, we are seeing a growing, burgeoning population and a demand for improved lives. I think it's going to be the big story of the latter half of the 21st century, and The smart nations, the smart enterprises are looking at it right now and trying to take advantage of it. I think you might have, certainly I was, struck by the strong presence of African professionals at the World Congress. They were also there last year, and they are very enthusiastic participants, and their challenges are deep, but I think we tend to ignore the fact that literally the internet use in the world is going to double here over this next decade. And a lot of that is going to come from places that we've not seen participation before. Another, technology trend, but I would say it's maybe bigger than that, in terms of adoption, is the penetration of artificial intelligence into the everyday use by consumers, other users. I think there's complex examples of this, and there's simple examples. One of them that I try to use in my presentation is Siri. I don't know what you may be seeing, but there's an awful lot of advertising in the United States that takes advantage of this, you know, this artificial intelligence component that's now embedded in the latest products coming from Apple. They've been there also in the Android phones, but many of the devices now are incorporating artificial intelligence. And we've also seen on the other end, on the mainframe, on the very large computing end, we've seen these amazing breakthroughs like IBM's Watson, et cetera. And eventually, I think you've got to think about the fact that within a decade, you may see some Watson-like sort of intelligence that's embedded in mobile machines and mobile devices, and I think that's going to have a very big impact in terms of usage, security, adoption, all of those kinds of areas. And then, if I were going to give one last trend in this area, I would say that innovation, which was a definite theme at the ISACA event, as a long-term strategy, is something that is with us for a long period of time. I think that eventually we're going to measure enterprise value, stock prices, the desirability of hiring candidates. We'll evaluate organizations. We'll develop metrics on innovation as definitely a key consideration in the future.
Now, I was struck by this whole idea of, you know, how there's kind of a political and also economic discourse around the world, and you mentioned Greece, but there's strife in some of these countries, right? There's people unrest, people protesting. Perhaps there's a greater surge of what we'd consider sort of the traditional right wing, not the right wing in terms of the U.S., but right wing in terms of fascism, perhaps. Or do you have any fears along that way? Maybe,
yeah.
You know, sort of what happened back in the early 1900s, and then the 1930s, what happened in Germany and so on?
Yes, I think it's extremely disturbing. As a boy, I lived for, just before my teens, I lived for 3 years in Belgium, and I can recall the riots that took place between the two parts of that society. There's a French-speaking society, and there's a Dutch-speaking society in Belgium. I work in Europe doing executive education on an ongoing basis, and something that's been incredibly disturbing to me is this paradox in the Netherlands of a strong rise of right-wing sentiment and intolerance of portions of their population, the Islamic portions in particular, that's been triggered by violence on the other side, and this is in potentially, or what it could be described as, the most liberal society in the world. This is extremely, as I say, paradoxical and upsetting. And that's, I think, taking the entrenchment of two different viewpoints to the extreme, and now we're seeing it play out in places like Greece and others.
From your own perspective, what would you say were the five key takeaways from the World Congress?
Well, there were a lot. I tried to come up with several that I think were perhaps the most important. I don't know, because I don't come at it from an IT professional's perspective, I may be a little bit off, but I'll give you my opinions. Number one, the fact that the user is in control. It's not the IT executive, it's not the IT department, it's the fact that the user controls. We heard a lot of referral to BYOD, which stands for Bring Your Own Device. That is not reversing. At last year's conference, the CIO of Lowe's, a very large home improvement store chain in the United States, said when he interviews executives coming into his particular area of influence in the company, they interview him as to what devices and what technologies they will use if he hires them, you know, and this is, you know, a manifestation of this. You know, technology conferences tend to focus on the technology, but this conference at ISACA, I think, had a recognition that it's all about the user. It's all about the other areas of the enterprise, and it's not IT-centric. So I think that the user is in control is one trend I'd point out, one takeaway. Secondly is the cloud. This is one of those things that gets discussed at conferences. The cloud has risks and it has rewards. It has two different sides to it. It's with us to stay. We are now seeing the kinds of things that involve the risks. Since that conference, we've seen the admission on the part of Dropbox, one of the larger providers of a cloud service to consumers. And in other words, cloud is but it's here to stay. It's not going anywhere. Third might be the fact that the technology professional is really a business professional with deep expertise. In other words, there's an aspect to an IT executive, an IT professional, that does not have to do with technology. It has to do with the kinds of other areas of expertise that need to be rounded up. At the ISACA conference and at a lot of executive conferences that I conduct, I used the metaphor that you saw me use in San Francisco of a Swiss Army knife. So, you know, I try to point out that it's not just the deep expertise in your field, but it's skill sets like persuasion and strategic thinking and the coupling of learning and unlearning ability and relationship building skills and foresight, the ability to forecast. I think those are all going to be in higher demand. Fourth on my list was the fact that the big breach, if we can refer to it as that, is just a matter of time. And by that, when I say the big breach is, there are all kinds of security breaches. But the big one, which I tried to allude to and which doesn't often get discussed, although it was at a panel or two at this particular ISACA World Congress, it's just a matter of time. And what I think that the thinking needs to revolve around is not what you do to prevent it necessarily, but what can you do to mitigate it, and how will you use that event once it comes to create better opportunities, to create safer environments, to better protect your organization. And then fifth, something that I thought was a takeaway and a theme is the fact that governance really recognizes the importance of information security. And by that I mean a corporate board of directors, an overseeing agency, in the case of government, et cetera. There needs to be more expertise that is either sitting in the room or can be called into the room for consultation and for deep listening. And I think there's a recognition of that. We saw it in several of the panels the year before. I think I alluded to the fact that we'd had a professional corporate director come in and talk about how that was so necessary to be able to include in the overall structure of organizations. So there's five for you, and I think they were certainly important. There might be others.
Bob, it's interesting in your five takeaways that you've given us a very kind of ecosystem approach, which I think is very valuable to our listeners. You know, when I've asked this sort of same question to other people who were speakers at the conference, and they typically were very technology focused, you know, like, you know, there's going to be a rise in this particular technology and this and some other technology, but you talked about user focus. You did talk about the cloud, but you also talk about IT being business professionals. The big breach in governance and related to information security. So it wasn't about devices specifically or a particular kind of technology. So that's was quite refreshing.
90% of the view needs to be outside of the cockpit.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I know that you sat the innovation workshop, and you mentioned it during your keynote and your moderation, how you really enjoyed that innovation workshop, and you really sort of put a spotlight on it. So what did you learn, and what did you find so valuable about that innovation workshop at the ISACA conference?
Well, as somebody who sort of thinks of, I think of myself not necessarily as a keynote speaker, but as a bit of a teacher, a facilitator and a teacher. And I love to watch those particular people that conducted it at work. This was a team from Deloitte who engage in helping their clients put together spaces within an organization that encourage innovation. Places to meet, places to gather, places and literally environments that encourage the kinds of innovative ideas. They were teamed with one of the great innovation consultancies in the world, IDEO, I-D-E-O. This is an organization that, years ago I met David Kelly, who head of the organization, was one of the founders and headed it for years. IDEO has the credit of inventing the mouse, for instance. They're an organization that does design work and consulting work with organizations. But I thought the session for in an hour was a perfect model of how to get across great information, and I love hands-on sessions. So in this session, in an hour, they managed to not only communicate valuable information about how to create space, environments for innovation, but they also gave the people in the room an opportunity to design one. And then to listen to and have a competition between the various designs that were come up with in the room so that we could see other people's work. And I especially admire the fact that they broke from the mold. ISACA, for this conference that you and I were at, puts down some rules about being a PowerPoint-free zone. What they mean by that is that they don't like to see an awful lot of slides go up with pictures of words on them and bullet points that just literally put audiences to sleep. But this group actually showed pictures of spaces that had been devised and had been used by organizations. How do you create a space where people can come together, engage in conversation, debate, discussion, collaboration, and come up with ideas that improve an organization or solve problems, etc.? So their pictures were just excellent. You know, it's one thing to speak about things, but it's quite another to be able to visualize them. And then after they discussed and they took some questions and answers for about 20, 25 minutes, they broke us into several groups in the room, gave us 15 minutes to develop a space. So our team essentially not only had to get to know one another, but to design a space for innovation, and in some cases there were some there were specific examples and specific situations, because the room was not only people from within organizations, but people who were consultants and others, and that's what happened in my particular group. So you design something, you have some visuals, you make a presentation, a very short. I think that we only had like 3 minutes to make a presentation afterwards of ours, and then they gave awards for the best ideas and concepts. But I think that the underlying value of that session was the fact that I'm a big believer that innovation is the way to the future. I think it's not only going to be applied to, hopefully, how we overcome the economic challenges that exist in the world today, but I think it's the solution to the world's problems. It's something that I alluded to earlier in this interview that I think is going to establish the value for organizations, and it's going to create value for decades to come. It's one of those things that is the great potential of human beings working together. So ISACA had this conference is essentially put together and really steered and governed by volunteers. They wanted interaction, fewer talking heads in sessions, and takeaway value. I just thought that this particular session on innovative spaces was exemplary.
It's interesting, Bob, but I think you were a key part of that dialogue and ensuring that there was a free exchange with the audience in the different workshops and the different sessions. And I know there was a panel session on innovation, and again, you were moderating that whole sort of session in terms of getting reach from the audience and getting them to interact with the panel, introducing the different panels, and mm-hmm. and then you tied that into your presentation, which is again really an interchange with the audience and generating ideas and getting people to collaborate. So it's just in fact I would highly recommend you to be involved at any conference out there. You're just terrific.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Now, Dew, in your presentation, you talked about ECRI, and maybe you can get a little bit, you know, tell me a little bit more about this Economic Cycle Research Institute, because I found the discussion really intriguing, and this idea that they've been pretty accurate in their forecasts.
And yeah, then, ECRI is one of those sources that I watch, and I might expand your question a bit and maybe talk about some other sources, but the most accurate forecaster, and they, although they tend to make predictions, they really think of themselves as a forecasting firm, is the Economic Cycle Research Institute, which is the you know, the acronym that you and I are using, ECRI, ECRI. And I, you know, I don't know them. I don't have any interest in them. But I, as an observation point, they're one of the things that I take into consideration. I'm a big believer that the best way to look at forecasts is to look at those that are a number of different viewpoints brought together, or a number of different factors brought together and essentially averaged or homogenized. I think that's the most accurate way to come to some kinds of conclusions. And they, over the last 50 years, have been the most accurate at forecasting business cycles. In other words, the downturn or upturn of economies. They, in December of 2007, for instance, forecasted that the United States was about to slip into a recession when no one else was really looking at it, you know, as reality. To give you an example, I was looking at aggregated opinion from several different sources. The Wall Street Journal, for instance, aggregates the opinion of 50 economists and publishes it. And I'm of the opinion that when you see greater than 25 to 30% of a forecast of opinion saying that we could be slipping into a recession, and then I think that's something that you need to factor in as a high possibility in order to have a contingency plan for it. And I was doing that back in 2006-2007, but ECRI actually called the recession in 2007. So I like their stuff. They're one of many information sources that I use, and if I can just sort of broaden on that, I think that one of the things that I love to do when I'm around executives who are successful is to ask them, what do you do to stay informed? Or what are the metrics that you look at most carefully that are outside of your organization? And typically I get a cross-section of those, but I also teach executive education sessions to Fortune 500 managers in the U.S. and Canada and Europe. And my topic for a full-day seminar is essentially anticipatory skills. What is it you should be doing on a regular basis without taking huge amounts of time out of the responsibilities that you have as a business professional, but what should you be doing on a regular basis? And I typically have an executive scanning system that I recommend. And, you know, there's specifics like the ECRI, but I think there's also, I think the more important way to approach it is to think about it as a discipline and to expose yourself to those kinds of sources that will alert you to what's going on. You need to be broadly informed. If you're going to move to the next level within your organization, if you're going to become more successful, if you're going to avoid nasty surprises, I think you have to be broadly informed. And I teach a discipline known as scanning, which is not necessarily reading huge volumes of things, but being observant to see things that are being mentioned, talked about, in some cases read in detail, that will have an impact on the future, an impact on the future of your organization, on the future of your nation, or specifically in your particular field. And I, you know, there's several components. I recommend, for instance, that daily an executive needs to be exposed to, needs to scan some kind of news source that has a global focus and is very probably has an infrastructure that allows them to see things. So, for instance, that typically we used to call that a newspaper, and we're still doing that today, although the days may be numbered for some things that actually get put on paper and distributed. But these days, I still recommend that for a business executive that there ought to be a daily exposure to something like the Wall Street Journal is one of my top recommendations. I recommend the online subscription versus the print subscription. Financial Times, very good for a business executive. I like the New York Times here in the United States. I think it's one of the great, examples of journalism, even recognizing that it has a particular political focus. Globe and Mail in Canada, Washington Post, you could use the International Herald Tribune, various British publications, etc. Weekly, I think also an executive should be exposed to something that I think is the standout publication, also available online, but I think The Economist is the best thing being done in terms of weekly journalism in the world. The Economist is forward-focused. It has a great reporting and editing team. It looks ahead. It's global in scope. It has an economic underlayment to it. It's the best weekly publication in the world. It's unsurpassed. In fact, if you go on their website and poke around for a bit, they have a T-shirt you can buy, which is inscribed with a simple phrase, "Only the T-shirt should go over your head." That I think is a perfect example of why it is that you need to engage in some kind of a scanning and information discipline. And I also think that it's necessary for a business exec, not on a deep basis, but I think to be at least exposed to some kind of business media at least once a month, preferably online. I recommend Fortune, Forbes, Business Week, just to stay plugged in. And not to read it from cover to cover, but to scan it, looking for the kinds of things that stand out as those kinds of things that you need to be informed about or things that catch your eye or that stick in what I refer to as a foresight filter, something that has implications for the future. I've become a user of and a big believer in, and I've recommended it to many of my clients, that Twitter actually has a great capacity to be able to take a divergent set of pieces of information and to be able to feed that into one source that you could maybe visit a couple of times a day to allow you to quickly scan, but then you can also hit those hyperlinks and drill into content that catches in your filter. And a lot of times I recommend that for time saving that individuals who are busy executives use read later aspects to productivity software and browsers. There's many of those out there. Google has some that are built in. I like I like Instapaper's read later function that I think is quite good. And then I also recommend that beyond, the business, the weekly, the daily, news sources that you expose yourself to some forward-looking sources. There are several of those out there. I like Wired magazine. I think Fast Company has good aspects to it. I still like MIT's publication Technology Review that has now gone totally online. And then I recommend Crosses. In other words, if an executive is in a particular field, you read sources and look at business publications and trade publications in other industries. If you're male, you ought to be looking at female appeal publications and websites and media channels. If you're young, you ought to be looking at things that are targeted towards those older than you, and if you're old, vice versa, essentially. And looking at global sources that are outside of your particular area. If you're in North America, you ought to be looking at things from Europe and Asia, for instance. And as I said earlier, moving outside of your industry. So there's a quick thumbnail sketch of what I think are essentially the best practices to be well informed.
Well, that's an excellent list, and I guess it pays to be plugged into a variety of diverse resources out there. And as long as you can, pick some key ones, then that'll put you in a better position to make the right decisions going forward.
Yeah, and there's the key. The key is to not spend huge amounts of time in it. The average individual is spending at least a couple of hours a day with media. It's how you shape that and how you build that habit of recognition.
Now, what are the five key disruptive forces that you see out there and why?
Oh boy. I struggled a bit with this question. There's so many, but I'll give you typically from my sort of work, here's the things. Natural disasters. The kinds of things that will impact an organization, a system, and a nation, and infrastructure, essentially, that we know are always probabilities or possibilities, but we tend to ignore them. We tend to deny them. Natural disasters are often what we refer to in my field and in the future studies field as wild cards. These are low probability, lower probability, but high impact events. So, you know, things like earthquakes and tsunamis, et cetera, those sorts of things are disruptors. Bad actors. They can be individuals, they can be nations, they can be governments, they can be, loose affiliations, but bad actors are key disruptive forces. Need to be considered, need to be watched. Obviously, in information security, we know the sources of some of those things. A disruptive force that we don't often think of, but here's how I sort of approach it, is human behavior. During our conversation on this interview, you've asked me about the political climate in the United States. What makes it so unpredictable is it focuses on human behavior. We look at the riots in Greece or the strife in Spain. We look at what's happened at the Arab Spring. These were all, to a certain extent, unpredictable, but driven by human behavior. So consumers, users, electorate, it's the underlying basis for what's often referred to as disruptive technology. And when you say disruptive forces, you might expect me to say technology. I don't think technology is a force. I think it's the human behavior that rotates around that technology that's the force. It's adoption. It's use. It's misuse. It's those kinds of things that are really the behavior, really the disruptor. So if, for example, in the IT field, there's an awful lot of attention given to SaaS, right? S-A-A-S, software as a service. There's an example. It's been around for quite some time, but the recent adoption upswing is what a lot of individuals are looking at as the disruptive influence for IT professionals. At the ISACA conferences, for instance, the last two World Congresses where I've been the moderator, is that there's been an awful lot of talk about the fact that, you know, the sales department or the sales wing of a large corporation went out and incorporated Salesforce and literally did it on a weekend without any input from the IT professionals. That's human behavior. And that's the kind of thing that I think is a key disruptive force. I also think if we were to consider information technology and others, is that unenlightened regulation, when you allow the regulators, when governments make snap decisions without contemplation and without discussion and debate, or in a deeply divisive situation that we've currently seen, I think you get unenlightened regulation. And I think we're seeing examples of that. We're seeing it in Europe. We're seeing it in the United States with some of the changes that we've made that haven't necessarily been effective to the financial system here in the United States. And I think that's a major disruptor. And then to come up with a fifth one, I put in something that is not often talked about enough, I think, and that is the lack of a forgetting curve. What I mean by that is that individuals are oftentimes evaluated within an organization on their ability to learn quickly. And I think it's essential, and I think it's important to do that. But I think it is equally, if not more important, to leave behind learning that is no longer valid, no longer relevant, no longer useful. And human beings have difficulty with that. Learning behavior, learning theory, has long held that integration, taking new information and incorporating it to your existing body of thought, is something that's recognized as an advantage, and it is. And human beings are taught that way from early infancy. But what is difficult is substitution. You know, Jean Piaget talked about it in his learning theory work, the ability to be able to substitute absolutely new information and new approaches and new behavior for old behavior, and that is extraordinarily difficult. So I think that the lack of a forgetting curve within an organization, within an enterprise, is something else that I think is a major disruptor.
That's quite a remarkable list, you know, going from natural disasters to what you call bad actors to human behavior to the unenlightened regulation to the lack of forgetting curve or dropping old ineffective learning. Fascinating and very true, by the way. So
glad you think so.
Now, what do you see as the five top opportunities out there, and why?
Well, I tried to come up with five, but I think there is an upside. I hope I haven't sounded too Cassandra-like in this interview, but I think there's great opportunities ahead. One of them is global prosperity. I think that technology is one of the things, one of the tools that we'll use to share information and knowledge, to shorten learning curves, widen communication, break down barriers, I hope, eventually, and eventually, I think, distribute more wealth to more people on the planet. And I think that it's a great opportunity. I'm a strong believer in that. I think that sustainability is a great opportunity. My politics tend to be moderate. I'm actually registered. I just recently changed my residence and I re-registered and I'm now a registered independent. So this is not a particularly liberal leaning. I just think that sustainability is a top opportunity for organizations, whether they be governments or corporations, et cetera. A couple of years ago, Accenture, one of the leading consultancies in the world, fielded a study asking executives of top companies globally how important sustainability is, and 93% of them said it was crucial to the future of their organizations. And I think there's a recognition on the part of top leadership in enterprises that sustainability's appeal to customers, its ability to differentiate, and I think there's a recognition that sustainability is the right thing to do. There's various definitions of it. I think the UN probably came up with the best one back in the 80s, which is to say that actions you're currently making do not jeopardize or take away from the ability of future generations to also do the same sorts of things. So that's my definition of sustainability. I've touched on innovation. We've talked about it a bit. I think it's also in one of the top five opportunities. Innovation is always there. Innovations, the ability to be able to do things better, faster, and to depart from the norm, to get out of the box, if you will, to be able to do something that is a breakthrough is something that is still a human trait. Something that Watson has not been able to to replicate. And I think it will be with us for some period of time, and I see it as a big upside. And then I would also say that one of the things that I see technology able to do, and since I'm sort of shading this in that direction, I would say that efficiency. Technology's ability to do things more efficiently is just tremendous. It's huge. And in an era of acute attention to financial metrics on the part of my clients, when I'm in strategy sessions with them, they're most often, discussing metrics, the measures of performance, and financial metrics are deeply impacted, I think, by efficiency. And it's a wonderful opportunity, I think, for IT executives to perform in extraordinary ways. And essentially, that's what I came up with in that particular area.
Well, that's a great list. I mean, global prosperity, sustainability, because I'm hearing about sustainability a lot, too. And, of course, innovations, breakthroughs, being out of the box, efficiency. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Great opportunities. And getting people to think just outside of peer technology as well, right?
Yeah.
So,
I agree with you.
Now, on the next question, I wanted you to sort of identify some major areas of controversy. But again, it doesn't have to be technology-based. It could be anything because, really, I feel that any executive should be aware of any areas that can have some impact on them, even though they may not be aware that it will have impact on them initially. So,
well, let me start on technology to begin with here, and then I'll broaden out for you. One of the areas of controversy, and I hear it debated in the situations that I get into, is technology good? Is it bad? Is it neutral? And I hear this debate, and there's usually strong opinions, in the room. And I see this when I'm holding enterprise-wide meetings, when I talk to groups of executives from a wide cross-section of companies, et cetera. And this often comes up, There people say, well, it's bad for my kids, or it's bad in this particular way, or it encourages bad actors, et cetera. And there's proponents on the bad side, there's proponents on the good side. Basically, I'm in the neutral camp, as I think I alluded to earlier. I think that technology is essentially neutral. I think it's adoption and use or misuse that provides the controversy. So technology in and of itself is I think neutral, but there's a lot of controversy, and you'll get people who will say that technology is an instrument of the devil, and those that say it is the way to the future. And I think all of those opinions have validity, but I think it's best to kind of come to some kind of reasoned approach to it. Another area of controversy that I find, especially since, you know, the majority of the listeners to this interview are going to be those who are in executive positions, is should an enterprise be responsible for the well-being of its employees and customers? It seems like such an easy answer, but the actual actions that are taken are not often in that area. And in decision-making meetings, I see debates on this. It's a huge area of controversy. Where do we draw the line in terms of the responsibility of an enterprise? Where is our area of responsibility? And I find that's one of those areas of controversy, and it is a difficult question to answer. I would also say that another area of controversy is a government's ability to limit citizens' access to information and knowledge. And I'm not talking about the developed and areas of the world. I'm talking about the kinds of things that we're seeing now in the Islamic countries, in the Arab Spring, in areas where there is essentially a fight for greater freedom of access to all things, including information and knowledge. There is a technology component to this, and this has existed for some period of time. I'm someone who is old enough to have I served in the U.S. military as a soldier in Europe when the Berlin Wall was still up, and I'll never forget my sister calling me on the phone back in 1989 and saying, "Turn on your television," and I said, "What channel?" She said, "Any channel," and watching people on the top of the Berlin Wall breaking it apart with pickaxes. And the chill that ran down my spine when I saw something that had been changed. And it's arguably technology that brought that to a conclusion. It was the ability to be able to spread information in those days through devices like the fax machine, et cetera, that actually encouraged and brought about some of the wholesale change that changed the systems in Eastern Europe, for instance. So I think that we're now seeing the much more technologically sophisticated impacts of whether or not governments can restrict access to information. In some parts of the world, including China, there is still deep restriction on that. And I think that eventually that area of controversy will be one that changes and actually alters that particular society in the future. If I were to give one other one, it's this, and it tends to be a little broader. How should an organization, whether it's a corporation, a for-profit corporation, a not-for-profit, a cooperative, a government agency, how should it deal with alternative viewpoints, or opposition, if you will, pressure groups, opposition groups, consumer movements, etc.? How do you deal with that? How do you approach that? How do you, there's oftentimes counter opinions to yours, counter interests to yours. How do you react to it? And this is one of the things that I think is a fearful trend in the United States, is this reaction to just reject and to never compromise with alternate viewpoints. But, what do you do? How do you approach this? How do you counterbalance the opposition? How do you consider their particular viewpoints? How do you compromise? How do you reach reason understanding? And that's something that I think is an area of controversy, and there's multiple approaches. I tend to be more on the side of, and I think that my most enlightened, most successful clients have been those that draw the line around certain things that they're not going to necessarily compromise on, but they're willing to certainly discuss, compromise, consider, and potentially improve in areas where they're being reacted to with some kind of opposition.
It's interesting, your last comment about dealing with diverse viewpoints. Maybe there are lessons there for the U.S. Congress.
If only. I would love to see that happen. Personally, I think that if I were making a decision on who to vote for myself, I would make the decision not necessarily along the lines of a particular viewpoint one way or the other on the conservative liberal spectrum, but more on the ability of that individual to to compromise and do the best thing for all of the individuals that they're representing in a democracy. So.
Well, again, in terms of your comment about the ability to compromise, I guess that also relates to this enterprise responsibility. You know, are you working towards the employee customer well-being? Maybe taking a little bit of a bigger picture, perhaps, right?
Right, as well as incorporating that. I missed the shareholder in there too. Those individuals that actually have an economic stake in the organization, they also need to be considered. That's why there's work for me to help with decision making.
And I guess it can't be solely the shareholder, though. Sometimes there's maybe too much of a focus just on the shareholder.
Exactly right. But putting them into that mix and on, I think, and there's where it becomes a difficult decision. I agree.
Well, it's interesting, the areas of controversy that you brought up, the technology question, the enterprise responsibility question in terms of whose well-being of the stakeholders should you consider, the controversy of government restrictions on information and knowledge, and then dealing with diverse viewpoints, to what degree should this be maybe encouraged within any kind of organization?
Exactly, any.
Now, you have this really interesting business. You have a consulting business. You moderate conferences. You're helping enterprises and executives. So what are your goals for 2012 and then the next 2 years in your work with Trend Talk?
Well, you mentioned the website. TrendTalk.com is the site that really is for the practice, and the practice is not this is not a big enterprise. This is essentially myself. I'm the president of the corporation, and someone much more important in my business is the CEO, the person who has the master's in business administration. A former college professor is my spouse, Madonna. She actually runs the business, so. So I'm a small consultancy, basically. I've had payrolls in the past. I've been in other industries, but I'm at an interesting point in my life. Right now I'm 65 years old, and I love the work. I don't love to travel, and there are times when the volume kind of gets to me, but I'm planning at this point to continue to work at a busy pace. When you've been at the work, and I've been at this for more than 20 years, this particular line of work, you find that the business comes. I'm going to work at the same sort of pace for at least another 2 years, and then I'm going to try to find a way to travel a bit less and create a little more time for myself in areas beyond business. I think I've got the right idea on how to do that. But I don't believe that I'll ever really retire. I think I'm going to stay engaged in foresight work as well as interesting aspects of strategy creation and decision making for some period of time to come. So I think that people who are in consultancies can shape the environment to a certain extent, but in many cases we need to react to it and to make ourselves available to it. So that's sort of my plans. And although it doesn't sound ambitious at this point in my life, I'm hoping to be recognized for wisdom instead of aggressive growing of the business at this point.
Well, you have a lot of wisdom and experiences to share, and this was very evident at the ISACA World Congress, and it was just such a great pleasure to see you at work. I mean, it was just inspiring, and it generated a lot of conversation and engagement. So are there some really essential lessons that you want to share from your really remarkable long history of success that will resonate with our audience?
I'll give you just maybe two or three points. If I were advising people, I would say no matter at what stage in your career you are, whether you're an entry level, whether you've been at it for a long period of time, I highly recommend finding something you love to do and get better at it. Recently, as part of the volunteer work I do with one of my associations, I belong to the Association of Professional Futurists. And I was reviewing several books that were being considered for an award that's given out every year by the association called the Most Important Future Works, and they tend to be multimedia and books. But I reread Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers. Gladwell, I think, is one of the best writers in the nonfiction space. And he's written several books that have a future focus to them, including The Tipping Point. But Outliers had a point that relates, I think, to this finding something you love and getting better at it. And it's his section of the book where he talks about the 10,000-hour rule. And he uses examples from some odd places, including the Beatles, who spent a very essential part of their early development as a band in Hamburg, Germany, playing on the Reeperbahn, which is the red light district of Hamburg. But they were playing these 10 and 12 hour sets in clubs there. But it was their ability to work together for that period of time that developed their expertise. And I think that getting better involves hard work and practice. And I think that finding something you love and getting better at it involves trying to think about, you know, what Gladwell pointed up as the necessity to put in the hard work in order to be able to continue to get better at things. I'd say also another point I'd make to success history is that denial is not strategy. The mistakes that I've seen so many of my clients make is that they engage in denial. This alludes back to the, you know, how to treat opposition among other things, but, you know, just to say that something won't happen or has no probability of happen or you would never do that is not strategy. I think that instead, to look at the possibilities and probabilities honestly and seriously. In some cases, you don't need to act on them. Maybe you just need to track them. Maybe you need to observe them. Maybe you need to think about them. Maybe you need to develop contingency plans. And I think that this ability to be able to look at things and alter your forecasts, and when action is necessary, that you make errors of commission as opposed to omission. Denial is not strategy. I'd also say that as a general recommendation to executives is to stay flexible and forward-looking. That might seem similar to what I just said, but I think there's a little more to it. I've been working with clients for a long time, I think over 26 years in this kind of work. And I came to this work by virtue of being a management consultant who was doing strategic planning facilitation with clients. I found that they weren't doing a very good job at looking at the environment ahead. And so I would do that for them. I would develop an environmental scan for them, essentially. But I find that it's better for me now to do the how-tos as opposed to necessarily do that work, because only individuals who are executives can bring the forward look in the right context. So I've been working with companies. In some cases, I've got clients that I've been working with over 20 years. That is far longer than the vast majority of CEO tenures. CEOs don't often stay in office, you know, for that long with a particular organization. And I think that those executives and those organizations that have done the best, that I've observed, that I've had close personal contact with, have had their eyes on the horizon and their minds and plans over it, over the horizon. They have not been afraid to change direction based on their foresight. Those are my recommendations.
I mean, those are excellent recommendations, and I guess this idea of executives always having their eye on the horizon, but within the context of their organization, but also not practicing avoidance either, right? So, yeah, those are great, great recommendations and lessons from your history. We're down to our last few questions now. This one's probably a little bit off our sort of our theme so far, and that is this whole concept of computing as a profession. Right now, it's not recognized as a profession. Like, when I mean a profession, such as with medicine or law or accounting or engineering, which are, you know, recognized professions. And with professions, you have things like adherence to the code of ethics. You may have some kind of credentialing associated with it, demonstrated professional development, public accountability, personal responsibility, quality assurance. You know, you go to a doctor and you get all of those kinds of things. What are your views about computing as a profession?
There's a difficult question. I think that the development, I think in any field of endeavor, I think the potential for developing a discipline, you know, ethics, as you point out, and credentialing, some kind of recognized set of standards, is a worthy goal. But I think it is extremely difficult, because I think computing, let's just say, you know, the term that you're using, Stephen, computing is a very broad term. and to take that and sort of arm it with a set of credentials, et cetera, is going to be difficult, I think. There's so many aspects, and I think that the continuing integration and what I think will continue to happen with computing is that it almost disappears into the organization. And why, I mean, look at the chief technology officers, the CIOs, you know, technology only appears in one way there. Computing is one of those action areas. I think that's difficult. But, here's what I would say is that I think it's a worthy thought, and I think it could be worked towards. And it involves the distinction between something that you just put in your question, which was the difference between professional societies and associations. So professional societies do exist in computing, but they're rather diverse, and they tend to focus on specialty areas. At least as an outsider, that's what I observe. Associations do exist. You and I were at a world conference of essentially an association. And ISACA gives out, if I'm not mistaken, something like four or five different certifications that people can then put, you know, in their title after them. But trade associations have a difficult time when it comes to ethics because business considerations come in. And how do you adjudicate, and how do you apply standards? It's really, I think, one of those areas that within a professional society you can do that. Within associations, it's difficult. The associations, I think, offer certifications as a revenue generator, and I think it's necessary, and I think it's worthy. But when you look at it, and I've been both ways, I essentially possess, although I no longer belong to a professional association in the speaking field, but I don't use that professional certification because I think initials after a name don't necessarily generate reputation. I think repute does. So I think it's a difficult area. So don't know if I had great clarity on my responses to that, but that's my observation.
Well, that's interesting. I think your response reflects some of the discussions that are occurring in the field, more broadly. Even to the point of should there be licensing, and I know that there are some attempts in some U.S. states, for example, to license software engineering. So, it's an evolving area, and computing is a relatively young field compared to, let's say, accounting or the broader engineering side or medicine. Now, Bob, you're the stellar recognized professional internationally, a top futurist, a strategy advisor, and you must have some interesting stories to share in your travels. Do you have any that you want to tell to the audience?
Let me see if I can be brief because I've been kind of long-winded on some of these responses. Let me tell a couple of stories that I think illustrate some of the points that I made earlier in the interview. One is I was on a project. I did some executive education within a large and I they shall remain nameless. Government agency in the United States, one of our largest, one of our most important. I will say it's not the defense industry, but it's a major government agency, highly recognized here. And I got pulled into a discussion in this consortium of top-level management who were trying to devise the future strategy for the organization. I was one of several consultants that came in over periods of time, but I worked with the group and tried to advise them. So here I am in a room with all of the disciplines essentially represented, and I would say this is the although we had a couple of the very top tier people in the room, it was largely second tier executives within this particular government agency. So we have identified strategic threats and strategic questions, and one of those involved the outdated information technology infrastructure for this organization. Very outdated. There were still punch cards being used within this agency in places, and programming that was still being done in the kinds of things that are not even, of course, being used anymore, and a recognition that in the future the demands on this particular agency were going to increase by at least a factor of 25%. And in a relatively short time horizon, they were going to go up, and go up dramatically. And the necessity for a new IT system was there. And you could tell who the IT people in the room were because the arms folded across the chest. And here was the statement that I heard. And if you've got IT professionals, you know, listening to this, here's what they said. No way are we going to tackle updates to the system. Our project capacity is full for the next 4 years. We cannot take on any more work. And that was the sticking point. Essentially, the technocrats were running that particular agency. And I tried my best on facilitation. I listened to debates. I even recorded videotape that I left at that organization that talked about the danger, the deep danger, the poison that was creating within their organization. Essentially, when I said earlier, you know, the fact that you got to be able to deal with controversy, deal with opposition, deal with diverse viewpoints to come to some kind of compromise. No compromise from the IT people. I think that was extraordinarily problematic in that organization. I think that was amazing as somebody from outside of the organization. I wish them well. I have not, because of budget cuts in the United States and our government, which have been severe and deep, I have not been back in to visit with that client over the last 18 months or so. I'll also use another example of a client, however, that did take action. I was with the board of directors of a company back in August of 2001. So I was in early August, and I was with board of directors of a telecommunications company. One that, you know, a lot of people would not know, but they were at the time the ninth largest provider of telecommunication services in the United States. The company had initially been family held, but the board of directors had been enlarged. They were publicly traded. They operated in a global environment with operations in Europe and in Mexico as well as the United States. So in the room, the directors were a really interesting cross-section of individuals. We had the CEOs of a major energy company, CEO of a major food retailer, one of the largest supermarket chains in the United States. There was a major accounting firm partner who was there in the room. There was a fellow who was very interesting, who was a retired investment banker who had done the initial public offering of Intel stock long ago, had held some of that stock personally, still did, according to what he told me over breakfast that morning, and he no longer worked. He was a professional director. That's all he did. And anyway, we got into it. I had 4 hours with the group to do a briefing and to essentially do a little bit of advisory work, although I didn't think it was going to be that much. But when I got into the portion of my presentation where I talked about looking ahead at a range of possibility and probability that enlarged, essentially the term I use is a cone of relative certainty, that IPO guy, the retired investment banker, stopped me. He said, stop. He said, I've never heard that before. He said, that's an interesting concept. He said, okay, you're a consultant. Use that. He said, tell us three things that are going to happen to this company that are very positive, three things that are negative, that are going to occur in the next 5 years that you think that we're not thinking about right now. And so I sort of shoved my hands in my pockets and gulped and realized that I was actually going to have to earn that fee. And I'm not going to bore you on this interview with all the things I said. I said on the positive side, at the time, this was 2001, August of 2001, I said, you have a product that you've developed and is deployable in the marketplace where a consumer can literally open a box, take out a device, plug it into the back of a PC, and power it up and do a little bit of work on the screen, and within 10 minutes you can be up and running with an over-the-air, essentially working off a cellular network, high-speed internet connection, which in those days wasn't that high speed, but it was essentially better than what was known as ISDN in that time. And I said, if you don't get that to the marketplace, if you do not put the money behind it, get it to the marketplace, priced as it is around a $40 per month price point. I said, the cable companies will get to the consumers before you. They will take high-speed internet as an option away from you, and you will very probably never recover that market share. I said, I'm 80% certain of that in the next 5 years. And as it turned out, I was right about that. On the negative side, I talked about a couple of things, but at the time I was also serving on the board of directors of a fairly large telecommunications company. And what I was really attuned to was the fact that this was an infrastructure company. Essentially, a telephone company is copper and cable and fiber that's strung around a particular geographic area. And I said, what I would say to you is that in the next 5 years, I am 80% or better certain that a catastrophic event in another area outside of your service area will affect you deeply, and you are very probably not prepared for it, you don't have a contingency plan for it, and you're not insured for it. And I gave examples, like in the prior year, a major storm in the northeastern United States had taken down ATM, cash machine networks all across the United States, and people couldn't get money out of ATMs in San Francisco because of an event, a natural disaster event that had taken place in the northeastern United States. I talked about the possibility of an earthquake taking out certain things on the West Coast. And the group was very interested in this, and they talked about some of their biggest risk areas. And the one that I facilitated a conversation, and they came up with this idea that a dirty bomb, essentially a nuclear device in a container ship that could contaminate an area, if it ever went into New York Harbor and took down essentially the Verizon service that they were reselling in their particular marketplace, that it would cause them deep problems with their consumers. They would lose market share. They also talked about the where their data centers were and the necessity to co-locate those, and they said it was a priority event that they needed to address within the next 30 days. So this was in early August of 2001, and we know what happened on September 11th of 2001. So the next day I got an email, because the phones still weren't working in the United States very well, from the CEO of that company, and he asked how I had predicted that event. And I, of course, wrote back to him and said, I didn't predict anything. I said, I forecasted with foresight that looks and takes into account uncertainty, adjusts with time and new information. I said, I forecasted the possibility of something occurring outside of your area. But I said, the real important question is, what about you? How did your actions, did you have contingencies in place and insurance? And he told me that they had revised their insurance policies to take that into account. Luckily, the Verizon network did not collapse, although it was on the verge of it due to the 9/11 events. But in that particular case, it is not just the foresight. It's the ability to take action as a contingency. And, those are the kinds of things, those are the kinds of stories I would tell you that I think are examples of why foresight is so important.
Well, those are very good stories to share, because there's some valuable lessons there that could be implemented by others. And it's interesting, I'm supposed to chair a board meeting coming up soon, so some of the questions you brought up I can use in my board meeting.
Okay.
Now, Bob, if you were conducting this interview, what three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answer?
Oh, you did a great job. You covered so much territory. I'm not sure I'd improve on them. I do interviews from time to time, and especially with media, and they tend to be usually soundbite type interviews. So I appreciate the opportunity to expand things. I thought that maybe a twist on this. I thought I might share with you what are the most common questions that I get asked by audiences as a futurist. And because I think there are a couple of them have good points. The most common thing I get asked is, what should I buy in the stock market? And I, of course, give the standard disclaimer, which I will give here, that I am not a licensed securities dealer, so I cannot offer advice on purchasing things in the stock market. I just don't know. My wife and I have small holdings in the stock market, so I really don't know. But overall advice I would say for investments that maybe I might just say is that what you want to be able to do is, invest in something you understand. But I think that the stock market is one of those things that is incredibly difficult to predict, because it involves human behavior. So that's why, one of the reasons why we shy away from that and tend to invest in things that we understand and where we can recognize value. One of the companies that I worked with in the past is Berkshire Hathaway, and the chairman of that company, oftentimes when talking to his shareholders, says that really the criteria for making investments involves, do you understand the underlying value? And that might be, so just to paraphrase him, that may be great advice. Second question I often get asked, I get asked it a little less frequently these days, but typically, if I'm working with a large group, they ask me, what should my child study in college? And I think there's two ways to approach that. The first is, and the first and most important is, what they want, what they want to study, what they're interested in. And I think that's what you've got to enable. And secondly, I have a bias towards liberal arts. I believe that it's one of those things that has, in large part, disappeared from the higher education scene. And I think that a baccalaureate education, a bachelor's or a four-year college education, should involve a broad base. It should fill out the things that weren't there in the education that came from high school. And I think that liberal arts should be something that that one should get a fairly broad basis in. The ability to be able to read, understand thought, have a perspective on history, to be able to write well, to be able to communicate well. I think the kinds of things that are the rounding out that we referred to earlier of a technical executive. On the technical side, I don't think there's anything wrong with getting that education as long as you fill it out with a broad liberal arts basis. I think it's one of the great opportunities, and that's one of the things that I think if I were advising, you know, my children, that I would emphasize. And then another question that I'm often asked that I think is important is, what about the haves and have-nots of society or of the world? And it's a difficult question. I think that, you know, one of the opportunity areas that we discussed earlier in this interview is the ability to have global prosperity. I think there's the haves and the have-laters. I think we're seeing examples of that come about in the world today. When we look at nations like Africa that is coming online, that of Asia and its burgeoning and prospering middle class, I think that there's haves and have-laters, which is the way I would put that. And information technology could be the great leveler as the world comes online and we see the effects on abusive government, as we see the effects on the spread of education, as we see the effects on the encouragement of innovation. And if I were someone asking me, is what's the best practice, single best practice, that would set me apart from my colleagues if I were an information technology executive, I would say that it's something I've alluded to earlier. It is ongoing scanning and forecasting on a regular basis, on an ongoing basis, in your mind, in your subconscious, if nowhere else, that you ought to be able to engage in scanning and foresight. And the ability to think about the implications. One of the things that I did at the ISACA World Congress was to have the group think about, if this happens, then what happens? What is the consequence, the result, the after effect? So if I'm going to set myself apart from my colleagues, if I'm going to have greater recognition of my abilities, it's the ability to forecast, look ahead, and the ability to think about, what are the implications? What does this event, trend, force mean in the future?
You know, that's really, really fascinating. And I'm sort of thinking of your have and have later. I was a speaker at the World Summit on the Information Society in Geneva, and it's a ITU UN event. And really, if you could summarize all the sort of discussions and what occurred at that sort of seminal event, it was all about have later. A sort of a recognition of that there's this burgeoning middle class and just going to get bigger and bigger. And there's programs like the Intel World Ahead program, which is trying to bring accessibility to all the countries of the world. And the U.S. government has this thing called the Alliance Program for Affordable Internet. It's the same thing. And then all of these, what we would consider developing countries, I'm seeing them have e-government, e-education programs, e-participation programs, all driven through technology, allowing transparency in governments, open governments, accessibility, providing economic stability, economic growth. It kind of ties into this have later idea. And I think you'd be a great speaker at the World Summit the next time it's held. And, you know, we were speaking before 193 countries, and I think there's something like 700 corporations, major corporations and organizations represented, because you could sort of crystallize all of the different themes that are discussed at the World Summit into sort of the key action items going forward. So I do have an interview with Hamid Antouri that's already been released. He's the Secretary General of the ITU. And, of course, the ITU is the premier organization in terms of governance, regulation, and standards information, communication, and technology worldwide. And I'll sort of maybe drop the suggestion of bringing you in next time they have another summit. I think you'd just be an excellent speaker for that. I guess on the other side.
That's very flattering. Thank you.
I guess on the other side, on this ongoing scanning and forecasting, you know, I do have two board meetings coming up and a planning session in September and October, and it's all about this sort of going outside of the box, but also scanning the entire environment, almost doing a sort of real-time SWOT analysis of just everything that's going on, and then doing some risk mitigation and forecasting what the opportunities are and what the risks are, and maybe the actions that could be taken, but it very much sort of ties into all the ideas that you've been talking about. So I can really sort of personalize, in terms of my experience, all of the recommendations you've been giving, and recommend to my audience that really you should be engaged. You're just really the premier executive out there, this top futurist, the strategy advisor, and I really enjoy this session with you, and I know your schedule's demanding, and you know, thank you for coming in today to do this interview.
My pleasure.
So I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Bob Treadway, internationally recognized top futurist and strategy advisor, keynote at the 2012 ISACA World Congress.